ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Regional councils say they're at the end of their tether with continued airline failures, and they say their communities are bearing the brunt of the cost, both in rates and the cost of airfares.
$600 return to Sydney for a 45-minute-hour flight, that's just ludicrous from a major port like Albury to Sydney.
And fears a timber milling village in regional New South Wales will become a ghost town to make way for the Great Koala National Park.
Everyone's very disturbed by it, and there's one bloke in particular, it's fourth generation, and he lives about three doors down. He's lost all motivation, he's kind of heartbroken really.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. Regional councils say ratepayers are being unfairly treated as failed airlines go bust and leave them with outstanding debts. Last week, two inquiries were announced which will investigate the reliability of Australia's aviation sector and the factors that determine regional airfares. While the inquiries are welcome, many already have put forward ways to make sure airlines serving regional areas stay reliable. Philippe Perez from Albury Wodonga has more.
Albury Mayor Kevin Mack has had enough of airlines utilising the local airport and then going bust. JetGo, Virgin Australia, Bonza and Regional Express have utilised Albury Airport in the past 10 years. Councillor Mack, who's the acting chair of Regional Cities Australia, says it's time the federal government did something to make sure a regional airline can service the regions.
To me, the government, if they can't demonstrate an airline that will stand the test of time, they need to look at underwriting it, because we need regional air transport. The cost of flying on Qantas is through the roof at the moment, and it's not fair, and it's a little bit like Woolworths and Coles. Sure, we can't tell the shareholders what or how they should arrive at their dividends, but seriously, $600 return to Sydney for a 45-minute-hour flight, that's just ludicrous from a major port like Albury to Sydney.
Albury City Council is owed nearly $1 million in debt from the four airlines. Councillors decided last week to write off about $250,000 owed to them by JetGo, but will continue to lobby the Australian government and Rex administrators for reimbursement of funds owed to their airports. Councillor Mack says there are solutions so that councils aren't left in the red if any future regional carriers fail.
There's been some suggestion and been represented to the federal government. They, under their licensing agreement, they provide a bond where there's ownership of their finances, and certainly if they do fail, they have money to pay or on pay or bank guarantee.
Other local governments across Australia are owed huge amounts from airlines that have gone bust. Wagga Wagga Council confirmed to the ABC that $310,000 is owed by both Rex and JetGo. While Mildura City Council could not disclose an exact amount, they confirmed debts of significant amounts were owed from both Bonza and Rex. Shadow Minister for Infrastructure, Transport and Regional Development, Bridget McKenzie, says there needs to be a better regulatory structure to encourage competition.
Rex, being under a cloud for a long period of time now, for over 15 months, has meant people don't have the confidence to use the Rex services. And when airlines aren't flying predictably, locals are choosing not to fly, and that means missing specialist appointments, it means missing family and friends' special occasions and economic opportunities. And it's been the local council that's been left holding the can.
Minister for Infrastructure, Transport and Regional Development, Catherine King, welcomed the decision by creditors to accept an offer from US-based company AirT to purchase Rex. She says the government have been careful in their approach in making sure Rex kept flying from their administration up until the recent decision by creditors. She says she's cognizant that regional airports are owed money from Rex, but as for money owed from other airlines that have gone bust, councils will need to find other ways to recoup their money.
What we've done is created a $5 million fund. It will be based on the creditors to Rex Airlines when they went into administration. Any other debts that are owed by other airlines or other previous airlines really is a matter for either the administrators or the airlines that are currently operating those.
University of Technology Sydney Chief Economist Tim Harcourt believes if correct decisions are made, regional airlines can be viable long term.
We have shown in the past that airlines have been able to survive in the regions. After all, Qantas itself was a regional airline when it first ran the rail run in outback Queensland. So we do have a strong history in regional airlines, and that means it shows it can be done.
But it can be a hard road ahead for anyone who wants to make money in regional air travel.
It is pretty tough in the regions. We are a big country. We have the tyranny of distance externally as well as internally. And we don't have large population centres like, say, the United States or Europe has, that really allows their regional airlines to make a better profit.
Philippe Perez reporting there.
You're listening to Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
For the past decade, the major banks in Australia made the decision to shutter many of their regional branches, leaving customers living in the country reliant almost entirely on online banking. Gone are the days where the local bank branch was a place where customers knew the bank manager and mortgages and lending could be discussed in person. Instead, customers are now driving often hundreds of Ks to access some personal service. Today, though, an olive branch from Westpac. The bank has today announced it will send bankers into country towns to work from the council office or local library one day of each fortnight. It also announced it would extend its moratorium on rural bank closure to 2030. That's 2.5 years longer than the other major banks. In a statement, the bank said it wanted to deliver on a better outcome in regional Australia. Queensland Senator Matt Canavan chaired the federal inquiry into regional banking, and he says there's still more support needed for the sector.
Post our inquiry, there has been a moratorium on bank closures, at least from the major four banks, and I welcome Westpac doing this today. The downside, or the less good news, is that we need to try and replace the financial services being lost in those towns where bank branches have closed.
Queensland Senator Matt Canavan. To discuss this, I'm joined by Dave Hine, who's the CEO of Regional Australia Bank. Now, they're part of an alliance of 23 small banks and credit unions, which call themselves the Regional Banking Investment Alliance, a group that's pushing for better access to banking in country areas. Now, Dave, what do you make of Westpac's announcement today?
Unfortunately, no. I have to see their announcement somewhat sceptically. If I pull it apart into the two bits, the moratorium essentially just enshrines the fact that they were the first to move many of their branches away from our regional towns and cities. The APRA data suggests that they only today have 186 branches across regional Australian towns and centres, and that, to be honest, is just not enough. And by challenging the other banks to join them in their moratorium, they're simply enshrining their cost advantage in not serving regional Australians with face-to-face banking services. On the second issue, as you put it, sending bankers into regional towns and putting them up in council chambers and town libraries, I'm not sure that sending people whose primary job it is to sell more mortgages really solves the issue that regional Australians are challenged with. Regional Australians need to see trained professional people on the other side of the counter who are capable of dealing with their cash needs, as well as sophisticated and complex transactions, not to have them sold to. So I can't help but see the announcement by Westpac today somewhat sceptically.
You represent a small operator, so you do have some skin in the game. It's probably worth, saying that. But a number of regional councils, there's a few in New South Wales that have got involved in this, and they've welcomed the move by Westpac to move, albeit a very small amount of face-to-face banking. Is it not better than the status quo, though?
Well, I think any announcement that recognises the importance of regional Australia and that banking is a critical service, of course, is something generally to be applauded. But is this a solution? It's not. It's absolutely not a solution to the challenge that we're still confronted with. Banks have still learnt that they can separate the expensive part of banking from the profitable part of banking, and this does nothing to change that whatsoever. It simply enshrines the competitive advantage that one bank in particular has over its competitors, and that doesn't help save regional Australians.
It's interesting that regional council property, as you said, council chambers and libraries could be possibly used for banking when in times gone by you just drive through any regional town, there's bricks and mortar banks left hollow. What do you think of that as a concept?
Well, I think the old bank branch was an important sign of stability and confidence in a community. And I really think that that we're paying lip service if we think that putting a few sales staff up in a council chamber is anything near the commitment that having full branch services within our small towns and communities really need.
There's something like 820, I think, regional branches across the country have closed down in a period of time, in about a decade. It's a huge number. Like you said, you can see it when you're driving through towns. You can see that the banks have up stumps. Has that, though, created an opportunity for someone like yourself?
Absolutely, it does. But beyond the opportunity for any one bank, I think we need to remember that there should be a fundamental social contract behind banking. That for each of us, for all of we banks, that to earn the right to make profitable business with regional towns and communities, we must first step up and serve them through the provision of face-to-face banking services. And that's something that, unfortunately, the modern banking world has forgotten, and it takes real public policy to resolve.
The Regional Banking Investment Alliance is pushing for the federal government to introduce what you call a cost-sharing model. Can you explain what that is?
Well, this is the first real opportunity I think I've seen for a piece of public policy to rejoin the expensive part of retail banking, that is the provision of face-to-face banking services, to the profitable bit, which many of our banks are very good at, and that is to lend to our regional towns and communities and to take deposits from them. And this piece of policy would see a joining of those two halves of banking in a much more sustainable way to ensure that our towns and communities can continue to seek the services that they need. This is a critical service after all, a critical service into our towns and communities, while our banks can continue to enjoy the opportunity to engage profitably in those towns and communities as well.
Can you break down the numbers of that? So you've got retail banking. So face-to-face is very expensive. Creating loans is not. It's very profitable. How do you make those numbers work?
Well, we've estimated that running a branch in regional Australia takes approximately $1 million a year to support. On average, that's a little over four trained professional staff to serve that town or that community. Now, that's a fairly expensive enterprise with little to no revenue directly attached. Now, I make the important stipulation that four to four and a half staff are not salespeople, as is promoted by the Westpac solution. These are people who sit on the other side of a counter and deal with the complex transactions and cash needs of our individual banking consumers across regional Australia. And the CSO, this Community Service Obligation proposal, would see that banks have a joint responsibility in funding that expensive part of banking. They can either do it directly in their own name via bricks and mortar and humans that serve our towns and communities, or they can do it indirectly via the CSO.
What sort of support would that need from the federal government for that to happen?
That would require the government reconsider an additional use of the banking levy. So this should not be an impost on the Australian taxpayer. This should be an impost on the banking community in whole. This is, again, an opportunity for us to rejoin the expensive part of banking to the profitable part of banking. And this would allow, via a piece of legislation, a rejoining of that of those two parts of banking, to ensure that all banks did their bit.
Over the next couple of days, there's going to be a discussion in the House of Reps through the Economic Committee about these kind of issues, and there's an expected interrogation of the major bank CEOs. What are you expecting to come out of that?
Well, I'm hoping that the inquiry would see through the lip service style solutions that we've seen in the past, whether they be talks of further moratoriums or the unfair comparison of banking services to solutions that rely on confident digital channels across regional Australia, in place of having trained professional people who can serve the complex needs in an increasingly dangerous banking world in our towns and communities. I hope that the committee really genuinely sees the need that our towns and communities are crying out for and finds within it the appetite to take a public policy step to resolve this challenge.
Dave Hine, who's the CEO of Regional Australia Bank, thanks for chatting to Australia Wide.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
The creation of the Great Koala National Park in New South Wales could mean a third of the workers in a rural village on the state's mid-north coast will lose their jobs. Pentark Forestry's Herons Creek operation is one of six mills directly impacted by the new park. It employs about 80 locals. Claire Simmons has been speaking to some of those facing job losses.
The mill is one of six included in a state government industry support package released last Tuesday for workers made redundant, 2 months after a logging moratorium was placed on 176 hectares of state forest between Kempsey and Grafton to create the park. But the mill workers were sent home today. They have been told there would be redundancies, but the site isn't closing. The union has been told the company is hoping to wrap up consultation this week, but this will depend on their ability to provide all the required information. They expect a Pentark Forestry Company official to be on site tomorrow, and workers will find out more then. Last week, we spoke to a union delegate working at the timber mill, Jake Pinkerton, who says the package is overall a fair deal, but it has been a difficult wait so far.
The last 10 weeks has been pretty nerve-wracking, honestly. Like, you're just kind of left in limbo while things are being sorted and you still don't have all the answers. We are still waiting on word on what actually is going to be affected during our jobs. We've got this package set up for people that do lose it, but we don't know who or how many will lose a job because of this park.
The latest census data has 246 people living in the community of Herons Creek, so the timber mill workforce is equivalent to a third of the population.
I'm not across the city on how many live in Herons Creek, but the sawmill there employs around 80 people and most are from the area. So you can imagine what that will do to a small community like Herons Creek if the sawmill is to shut.
In a statement, Pentark Forestry declined to comment, but a spokesperson said it is currently working through the New South Wales government's announcement regarding the Great Koala National Park. The park was a key environmental commitment the Minns Labor government took to the state election, but the immediate logging moratorium announced in early September and the scale of the park took many in the timber industry by surprise. Herons Creek union delegate and mill worker Bodie Moy was among those who were shocked.
It's been in the works for a couple of years, this koala park. We were aiming to try to get a smaller version of it, but then on Father's Day of all days, they announced the largest possible at 176,000 hectares.
There are just 80 houses in Herons Creek, and the street where the timber mill is located is mostly housing for workers. So any renters made redundant will also need to find new housing.
Everyone's very disturbed by it, and there's one bloke in particular, it's fourth generation, and he lives about three doors down. He's lost all motivation, he's kind of heartbroken really.
But as affected timber mills are still to learn what their losses will be under the North Coast wood supply agreements from the logging moratorium, the full job losses may not be known for some time. The New South Wales Minister for North Coast, Janelle Saffin, says about 300 jobs would be directly impacted by the logging moratorium. Ms Saffin says she understands no worker wants to lose their job, but the package they've negotiated with the union and industries is for the workers made redundant.
There's top-up redundancy payments, and that's 4 weeks base pay for each year of employment, capped at $150,000. There's additional support if employees are over 45 years, a further 3 weeks of pay for every year of service, capped at $50,000. There's education training payments up to $9,000. If there's a relocation payment of up to $45,000 if you have to move more than 50 kilometres for new employment, and of course there's free access to health support.
Timber, Furnishing and Textiles Union Secretary Alison Rudman says the worker package match compensation awarded to Victorian timber industry workers when native forest harvesting ended there.
It's our members who are impacted by this, and they've been at the forefront of these discussions all the way along. The package announced shows timber workers the respect that they have earned. It allows timber workers who lose their jobs because of the state government's supersized Great Koala National Park to leave the industry with dignity and options for the future.
A resident of Herons Creek for the past 28 years, 79-year-old Ron Morris says everyone is concerned about the future of the community.
So it's going to be very difficult for them, and for us to lose the number of people we've moved out of Herons Creek, it'll just make it like a ghost town.
Herons Creek resident Ron Morris, ending that story from Claire Simmons. Now to the great southern region of Western Australia, where the community of Esperance has gathered to remember the four lives lost in devastating bushfires 10 years ago. But as Tara de Langraft reports, some people believe more needs to be done to prevent a similar disaster.
Four lives, 300,000 hectares of land, 30,000 hectares of crop and thousands of head of stock. The date November 17th, 2015 will forever be etched in the minds of Esperance locals. Three separate blazes, started by lightning 2 days prior, created an inferno like no other. In the years since, there's been two inquiries, one public, one privately funded, and Coroner Sarah Linton made 12 recommendations in the wake of her inquest, a bid to ensure that kind of event never happens again. In 2020, the state government said it would support or support in principle 10 of those recommendations. They included boosting DFES offices in the state southeast, which currently stands at 5, the installation of a phone repeater tower at Peak Charles, 5 new light tankers for the Esperance region, and an aerial firefighting fleet deployed to regional areas, including Esperance at the start of harvest. The state government decided not to adopt recommendations to instill a career fire station in the state southeast, or to allow for the purchase of earth-moving equipment which could be used during mitigation works. Grasspatch farmer Dan Sanderson says while the state government has increased funding for mitigation, it's nowhere near enough.
Things have got a lot better responding to fires than what we went through in 2015. The lack of machinery, aircraft, personnel available when we needed help wasn't there. It was hard to come by. We've got a long history of very good chief bushfire control officers in the Shire of Esperance. We have a really good shire that's, especially since 2015, that have been wanting to work better with brigades and fighting fires and mitigation. So a lot of that has improved, but there's still a fair bit that needs doing.
Mr Sanderson was one of three farmers who spearheaded a privately funded review into the bushfires, along with David and Linda Campbell. Mr Sanderson says a decade on, he's no longer angry, but he is still frustrated.
When I started on this review into the fire, I was angry and I was frustrated. I've since learned that it's fine to be frustrated, but it's wrong to be angry. All you do is build a brick wall when you're trying to talk to people. So I've changed a fair bit and I've learned a lot. There's only a limited amount of money. There's not enough money. The ESL is huge. It's about $500 million a year. And there's only a small fraction of that comes to volunteer bushfire brigades. So I was looking at cost-effective solutions, and I've given up on the cost-effective solutions. All I want is effective solutions, and that's probably been the biggest change for me in the last 10 years.
Greg Curnow farms at Cascade. His uncle Kim, or Freddie as he was known, lost his life in the blaze. The coroner found the four deaths on that day arose by way of accident. Greg says it's hard to believe it's been 10 years.
We were particularly strong at the time about not assigning blame. We really just wanted proactive change and improvements for the safety of people, lives and property. There has been some really good improvements and aspects to it, particularly on a local level with the Shire and DFES working well together on a local level. There are aspects that are quite disappointing though and still really haven't been addressed in a meaningful way.
He says a decade on, mitigation is still their number one concern.
Looking from the outside and talking to people, I think it's, from what I can gather, there's a lot of conflict between agencies and organisations, not a lot of organisation, and really, at the end of the day, these things should be left to the local brigades to run. It'll be far more efficient. It will get done properly and safely at a fraction of the cost.
Since the Esperance fires 10 years ago, the state government says it has significantly increased its spending on bushfire mitigation on-ground works. It says $9.5 million has been granted to local governments through the Mitigation Activity Fund Grants Program, with $1.15 million of this spent within the Esperance Shire. Additionally, in the last financial year, DFES said it spent $80,000 on unallocated Crown land and unmanaged reserves within the Esperance Shire, specifically targeting on-ground works. The state government says the emergency management landscape and framework has undergone significant reform since 2015. A rural fire division's been created, written notification procedures are in place for when a fire officially gets handed over, and work has begun on an emergency services exposure draft bill. Dan Sanderson says the bill has been a long time coming, and he hopes rural brigades will get a chance to review it before it's enshrined in law.
Looking through my notes from 2017 when we tabled our review and saying, yes, in the next 2 years, we're going to be looking at these acts and it's going to be done. Here we are 8 years later and it still hasn't happened. And I'm concerned now that it will get rushed through and there will be like 3 months. You can have a look at it in 3 months. It's 3 months is not going to be long enough to look at it. We're going to need to have a look at it, go through it.
DFES says regional brigades will have the opportunity to comment on the exposure draft bill once it's released for public comment. This morning, a remembrance service was held at the Jetty Headland in Esperance, with family members from across the globe travelling to the state's southeast to remember the four lives lost. Both Mr. Kernoy and Mr. Sanderson say while time has passed and the community is rebuilding, they will stop and reflect today and hold hope that an event of this magnitude never happens again.
Oh, time has definitely helped. There's no doubt about that. It's been tough. It's still painful, but it's, yeah, something we reflect on and, yeah, life goes on and we need to make sure that it keeps going on.
Cascade farmer Greg Kernow speaking to Tara de Langraft about the devastating fires that killed four people in Esperance a decade ago.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
And there are many people on the harvesters right now, so we're going to have a look at what sort of music they're listening to. Move Over Hottest 100, South Australian farmers have contributed to their own annual music poll to count down their top songs while counting down what are very long hours behind the wheel harvesting crops. Now in its fourth year, Grain Producers South Australian Harvest 100 playlist has been topped by a quintessential Australian rocker and South Australia's own. Brooke Neindorf has the story.
Working hard to make a living, bringing shelter from the rain. A father, son left to carry on.
Jimmy Barnes's Working Class Man has claimed the number one spot in Grain Producers SA's annual song countdown. It's a fitting choice for the poll, with many farmers struggling to get a worthy crop out of the ground after two consecutive years of drought. Farmers can work long days without much of a break as they race to harvest the crop while it's in peak condition. That optimal window means the job needs to be done and dusted before rain comes, which can temporarily stop harvest and reduce crop quality. For farmer Sally Zacker on South Australia's Eyre Peninsula, she can be starting her day early and be going until the next day.
Harvest is such a funny one. Like we've had nights reaping till 2 and 3 in the morning because there's been a change coming through. But honestly, if the weather's right, you just keep going. Same with the chaser bin driver, they're out there as well. As long as you've got storage, you just keep reaping.
Under such manic pressure, it's important for farmers to have something to keep them going, which was the idea behind the Harvest 100 playlist. And the man behind the winning song, Jimmy Barnes, was pleased to top the poll as the song was written in tribute to hardworking people like Australian farmers.
I was so thrilled to hear that the farmers voted Working Class Man top of their Harvest 100 playlist this year. That song was important to me. This is a song written about my audience, about people just like you farmers, people who work hard, people who strive, you know, to make a living and feed their families. And then on the weekend, maybe they might kick their heels up occasionally and come out and see a band play or listen to music at home.
It's the second time Barnes has won the countdown, taking top spot in the inaugural Harvest 100 in 2022 with Driving Wheels. Organised by Grain Producers SA, the vote was devised as a fun way to bring the harvesting community together and celebrate another hard year of work. GPSA Chief Executive Brad Perry says the winning song was a fitting choice given the conditions farmers had again endured across much of the state.
And I think it reflects that it's been a hard slog this year.
And just like there are many different types of farmers, the countdown this year is an eclectic mix that's been pulled together in an online playlist with everything from dance floor classics, more modern music and some good old country tunes. Misaka says it was a great feeling to get a shout-out by Jimmy Barnes during harvest this season, as his music has helped her through some long hours sitting in the chaser bin.
You know, he's from Elizabeth. He's South Australian, but it is pretty cool. And, look, his music is pretty iconic.
SA's grain production this year is estimated at 8.5 million tonnes, higher than last year, but still below the five-year average after some regions missed rain during key growing times. And while parts of the state have started harvesting, most areas will have to wait a little bit longer before pressing play on the Harvest 100 playlist.
A bit of Jimmy Barnes finishing off that story from Brooke Neindorf, with additional reporting from Selena Green and Elsie Adamu. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.